A Wild Excursion. Back out on the plains, the Union Pacific had no such formidable geography or geology to slow it down, and it was making remarkable progress. By May 1866, its construction crews had laid more than twice the miles of tracks than the UP had set down in the more than 2 years before Casement and Dodge had been hired to the project. By now, the building of the Transcontinental had become the nation's biggest story. Every newspaper from San Francisco to Boston sent correspondents to the work sites. Casement's army was being followed by an army of writers. Among them was a reporter for the Philadelphia Bulletin. It was, he wrote, worth the dust, the heat, the cinders, the hurrying ride, day and night, the fatigue and the exposure, to see with one's own eyes this army of men marching on foot from Omaha to Sacramento, subduing unknown wilderness, surmounting untried obstacles, and binding across the broad breast of America the iron emblem of modern progress and civilization. All honor not only to the brains that have conceived this railroad, but to the indomitable wills, the brave hearts, and the brawny muscles that are actually achieving the great work. Other than the progress of the road, the journalists had another big story to tell. Railroad service was not going to wait until the Transcontinental was completed. As soon as tracks were laid between one destination and another, trains began rolling between the two points. The once empty plains were now filled not only with the sounds of hammering and drilling and workmen's shouts, but with the sound of the new symbol of the age, the locomotive. Less than a week after the rails were laid through Kearney, Nebraska, a New York Times reporter stood amazed as the first train from Omaha rolled in. "And tomorrow," he wrote, "shall see the first eastward-bound train. Yet already the road has been built 2 miles further on. This in one day." Increasingly, the first thing many readers turned to in their newspapers was any story that carried the dateline, "End of the Tracks." One of the most interesting stories had to do with a 21-year-old rifleman named William F. Cody. According to various end-of-the-tracks reports, when certain of the UP crews found themselves running short of beef, Cody had been hired to go out and shoot buffalo to supply meat to them. He had quickly come back with more meat than the workmen could possibly eat. Only then did they learn that, young as he was, Cody was already becoming a legend for his buffalo shooting skills. Soldiers traveling with the construction crews told them of the time Cody had astounded them by slaying 11 buffalo with just 12 rapid-fire shots. Although the workers did not realize it, they had employed a man who was to become one of America's greatest folk figures. William Frederick Cody, eventually known by millions of people as Buffalo Bill, was born on the Iowa prairie in 1846. He was only 11 years old when he went to work as a messenger for a wagon freight company. 2 years later, he went mining for gold, and he was only 14 when he answered an ad for skinny expert riders willing to risk death daily and joined the Pony Express. During the Civil War, Cody became a scout for the Union Army, where he astounded his superiors with his riding and shooting skills. According to his own accounts, he earned the nickname Buffalo Bill by killing 4,280 head of buffalo in 17 months. When the Transcontinental Railroad was completed, Cody returned to the Army, where he earned further acclaim as Chief of Scouts for the 5th Cavalry. He performed so heroically that he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. It was a time when small books called dime novels were extremely popular. Beginning in 1869, Ned Buntline, the most widely read writer of these publications, created a Buffalo Bill series. The stories he wrote were a mixture of amazing facts and romantic fiction, and they made Buffalo Bill as great a folk hero as Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, and Kit Carson. But Buffalo Bill's greatest fame was still to come. Cody was a born showman, and in 1883 he organized Buffalo Bill's Wild West, an outdoor extravaganza that dramatized many of the aspects of frontier life that had captured worldwide attention, a buffalo hunt, a Pony Express ride, the robbery of a stagecoach, a recreation of Custer's Last Stand. Among the stars of the show were Cody himself as Buffalo Bill, the woman sharpshooter Annie Oakley, and the famous Native American chief Sitting Bull. For more than 30 years, Buffalo Bill's Wild West played to enormous audiences throughout the United States and Europe. By the time it was over, William Cody had become one of the most famous people in the world. A man of boundless energy, Cody played a major role in founding the town of Cody, Wyoming in 1895. There, along with opening a hotel, he established the T.E. Ranch, which eventually grew to some 8,000 acres and ran more than 1,000 head of cattle. Cody also opened a dude ranch and a big game hunting business. Cody made a fortune from his show business and ranching successes, but lost all of it due mainly to bad investments. He died on January 10, 1917, and is buried in a tomb blasted from solid rock at the top of Lookout Mountain near Denver, Colorado. Buffalo meat was not the only addition to the UP workers' diet. One day, when Grenville Dodge returned to camp, he asked the cook where he could find two men named Rollins and Dunn, with whom he wished to speak. The cook told him that they had heard there was a giant grizzly bear in the area and had gone out to try and shoot it so they could all have bear meat for dinner. "It was but a short time," Dodge would later write, "until we heard two shots, and in a few minutes afterwards, we saw Rollins and Dunn coming towards us with the greatest speed. I knew then they had shot at the bear and had wounded him, and he was following them. As Rollins and Dunn came up, I saw the bear was close, and I drew the bear's attention, giving me a very good shot. But I hit him a little too far back, but did not stop him. The cook waited until he got him face to face, and then shot him between the eyes and dropped him. He was one of the largest grizzlies I ever saw." By the end of the summer, Casement's workforce, spurred on by a whole new development, was moving across the plains faster than ever. In a startling and totally unexpected move, Congress had lifted the restriction that stated that the Central Pacific could lay its tracks no farther than 150 miles beyond the California-Nevada border. Now the CP was allowed to lay as many rails as it could until its tracks and those of the Union Pacific came together. Suddenly, the building of the Transcontinental Railroad had become more than the greatest construction enterprise the United States had ever undertaken. It had become the greatest of all races, one that would be intensified not only by the amount of money to be gained with each mile of track laid, but by the egos of men like Charles Crocker and James Strobridge and Tom Durant and Jack Casement, men determined that it would be a race that they would not allow their company to lose. From the time that both the Central Pacific and the Union Pacific had begun laying their tracks, each company had hired individuals to secretly check on the other's progress. Encouraged by its spies' reports of the difficulties the CP was having in the mountains, the UP pushed its advantage, hired scores of additional graders, and sent them 100 miles ahead of the track layers. Grenville Dodge, determined to outdistance the Central Pacific as much as he could before it broke out of the Sierras, packed up his surveying equipment and set out for Wyoming to plot a final route through the Rockies. At the end of its tracks, Casement's crews stepped up the pace as never before. "Wonderful indeed," New York Herald reporter Henry Stanley wrote, "is the rapidity with which the roads are graded, ties laid down, and the rails secured to their places by the railroad makers. Squads of Irishmen under energetic taskmasters are scattered all along, working with might and main." In early October 1866, the Union Pacific's tracks reached the 100th meridian of longitude, 247 miles west of Omaha. It was both a milestone and an occasion for celebration. And for Thomas Durant, it was something more. Despite this great achievement, the UP had a major problem. It was seriously short of funds. New investors were needed as quickly as possible. Now, in the 100th meridian achievement, Durant saw a golden opportunity to attract donors to the Union Pacific. It was also, he believed, a chance to gain huge publicity for the UP. He decided to celebrate the accomplishment by inviting specially selected individuals and their families to take part, at the UP's expense, in an excursion to the 100th Meridian. It was to be a party, but not just any party. Durant was determined to make it an extravaganza, something that people would never forget. He began by inviting more than 300 of the nation's most influential people, congressmen, cabinet members, leaders of business and industry. Among the more than 200 who accepted the invitation were Rutherford B. Hayes, future President of the United States, Robert Todd Lincoln, son of the martyred president, French noblemen, a Scottish earl, and, to Durant's delight, a large number of millionaires. Along with inviting reporters from every one of the country's major newspapers, Durant also hired two photographers to record each of the several days' events he had planned. He topped it all off by acquiring a portable printing press and hiring a newsman to publish a daily account of the excursionists' experiences. In mid-October, those who had accepted Durant's invitation assembled in New York City. From there, they were taken by train to St. Louis, where they boarded two elegant steamboats that Durant had leased to take them to Omaha, where the extravaganza would culminate. Throughout the two-day voyage, they were treated to the music of two separate bands. A magician was on hand to entertain them. There were even two barbers present to trim the mustaches, sideburns, and whiskers of the gentlemen guests. The highlight of the trip, however, was the dinner that was served on the first night out. The excursionists were people used to elegance, and they were no strangers to opulence. But none had ever experienced anything like the meal that, for 3 hours, was set before them. For the occasion, Durant had hired one of Chicago's most famous chefs, and directed him to prepare the most exotic array of dishes he could. The chef did not disappoint. Aside from the various soups, gumbos, and appetizers that led off the meal, the excursionists were served 6 kinds of boiled meat, 7 varieties of roast meat, 10 types of cold meat, and 29 different main courses. They included dishes of duck, venison, wild turkey, rabbit, and quail. Pyramids of candies, fruits, and other desserts also were part of the menu. Somehow, all the guests survived the gluttonous meal and the dancing that followed. On October 22nd, they arrived in Omaha, where they were given a tour of the facilities the Union Pacific had erected there. The excursionists gazed in wonder at the roundhouse that could shelter 20 huge locomotives, the 2-story machine shop, the blacksmith shop that contained a dozen forges, and the long car shops where UP mechanics and craftsmen were producing some 10 railroad cars a week. Durant made certain that the employees conducting the tour emphasized how facilities like these were prime examples of the strength of the UP, the bright future it had in front of it, and how wise it would be for an individual to invest in the company. The next day, the main attraction began. Accompanied by the two bands, more than 200 excursionists set out for the 100th Meridian. The 9-car train in which they traveled was led by 2 smoke-belching locomotives decorated with deer antlers and American flags. Most of the excursionists rode in 4 newly made passenger cars adorned with thick carpets and heavy elegant drapes. Members of Congress and other particularly important guests were seated in a specially constructed parlor car that had chairs upholstered with silk. Durant had reserved the most special car of all for himself, his family, and his friends. It was called the Lincoln Car. The late president had never ridden in it while he was alive, but it was the car that had become famous for having carried his body in his funeral train. The last 3 cars of the train that one reporter would call the most sumptuous and resplendent, not only in America but all over the world, included a gentleman's smoking and drinking car, a cooking car, and a car that held baggage and supplies. Durant had planned the train trip west as carefully as all the events that had preceded it. When the excursionists arrived at their first stop, They were greeted by a roaring campfire and a collection of tents in which they were to spend the night.